a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
Tonight, the police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles was second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
We're taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep. And that's about it. And we went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while. And that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who was playing? That's what the whole thing is. That we were all we was doing out there was playing. You know.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. Very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains and just like a deer. And he just wandered around.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on the refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me after an extended break as we prepare to take our second look at Charles Manson and his infamous family. Before we get into it, however, as always, we have the normal show notes and plugs. If you would like to follow me on social media, that'd be Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. Just search for Ian Totten Author. You can also find me on MeWe under that moniker. You can find me on Twitter, Truth Media, under Corpse Creek. I'm also now on TikTok under Corpse Creek. If you'd like to sign up for the show's mailing list, you can go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. While you're there, please consider picking up an autographed copy of one of my novels. You can also make a donation if you would like to help the show with its production costs. If that doesn't work for you, you can always go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon and sign up to become a Patreon member for as little as $2 a month. Lastly, if you enjoy this show, please subscribe wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts and consider leaving a 5-star review. They really do help get the show out there to more people, and I will read your review on air. If you don't like the show, that's fine. Just move along. There's enough negativity in this world that we don't need your assholiness dragging down what it is I'm doing. All right, now that all the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfortable chair, kick back, relax, I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go back into the crypt. When we left off a few weeks back, Sharon Tate was in London. She had been in a relationship with Jay Sebring, the hairstylist to the stars. As so often happens in Hollywood, however, her relationship with Jay, who was her fiancé, was doomed not to last. Because while she was in London, Sharon met Roman Polanski, who was a budding filmmaker, and in my opinion, an individual without morals who was simply out to get what he could out of other individuals. At this period in time, Polanski was working on a film which became known as the Fearless Vampire Hunters, which, if you've never seen it, you're lucky. It's one of the worst films I've ever sat through. This is why he was in London. He was working on this film script when he met Sharon Tate. Story goes they met, and a few days later, mind you, Sharon is still engaged to Sebring, she goes out to dinner with him and afterwards goes back to the house that Polanski was living with, at which point they drop acid before making love early in the morning hours. So much for being a faithful individual to your supposed love of your life / fiance. After this point, however, Polanski and Tate really become inseparable. By a number of accounts, the news that Sharon had dumped him and was now going out with Polanski was devastating to Jay Sebring. I have read some reports that state that he actually flew out to London to discuss things with Sharon before flying back to Los Angeles. One thing that's not really talked about enough is how much more of a dominant personality Polanski was than Tate. We've discussed it in the last episode, how she tended to gravitate towards men who could really control her, and Polanski was of a similar facet. I've read some pretty horrific things concerning the two of them. This despite the narrative Hollywood likes to give off that they were this amazing couple who were madly and deeply in love. Polanski worshipped the ground that Tate walked on. If you actually look at the facts of their lives together, that seems to be in direct conflict with, you know, what we're generally told about the two of them. But we're getting ahead of ourselves slightly. Polanski had released at least two films by this point, and the people at Filmways, to whom Sharon Tate was contracted, were so impressed with this that they decided to sign on for his next film, which became The Fearless Vampire Hunters. And Sharon's manager at the time, I believe his name is Marty Rancinoff, kept pushing to have Polanski screen test Sharon for the role of the innkeeper's daughter. Despite Polanski's protestations that he wanted to use his former girlfriend, actress Jill St. John, eventually Polanski relents and Tate does a screen test for The Fearless Vampire Killers or Fearless Vampire Hunters. I've seen it written as both. And she gets the part. And really, my personal opinion, this was just a way for Roman Polanski to videotape Sharon Tate nude, as there are a number of scenes within the film of her naked. Again, it's an absolutely awful film. How Polanski is seen as this master of cinema, given the films of his I have seen. I have no idea, but it's really bad, as was Tate's acting in the film. Again, I talked about this last episode. I don't hold back and I don't pull punches on this show. She was an awful actress. Some people are going to take issue with that. That's fine. I don't care. Fuck them. The truth is in the pudding, as they say. She never got any better as far as being an actress went. And this is, you know, in contradiction to, again, the line that Hollywood and the media likes to push. She was this amazingly talented, big-time actress when she unfortunately passed away. No, that's not true. She got roles because of how she looked. With Polanski, there was a lot of partying, a lot of drug usage, and a lot of manipulation on his part to get Sharon to conform to the things that he wanted her to do. And this was evident even while they were filming the Notorious Vampire Killers, as Polanski has been described as a taskmaster while making films, in that he demanded perfection from those that he was directing. Again, Tate was not a good actress, and there are stories out there about Polanski taking hundreds of takes with her on the set of The Fearless Vampire Killers for a single scene because she was so far out of her depth. And I have to believe that this controlling nature of Polanski in his filming life further cemented his control over Sharon Tate, who, as has been discussed, really seemed to desire a strong and controlling man in her life. Any event, not long after Easter of 1966, Tate ends up moving in with Polanski. There are stories from this point in time of Tate really becoming domesticated by her life with Polanski. But there are also stories of them hosting lavish parties at their home that were frequented by such luminaries as Warren Beatty and Yul Brynner and numerous other Hollywood names who were known to be something of womanizers. This point in their relationship, the more seedier aspects of things had not yet begun, but they eventually will. If you don't know what I'm talking about so far as seedier aspects, you're going to have to wait until I get to the murders and what took place immediately following them to find out. It's interesting to note that during this period of time around Easter of 66, Tate gave an interview where she claimed that one of the main reasons that she broke off her relationship with Jay Sebring was that he was attempting to dominate her too much. Which is funny considering who she left him for and what was to come. Also during this time, it has been noted and documented that Sebring began dating a 15-year-old girl by the name of Catherine James, who has been described as a top-tier rock and roll groupie who wrote a book by the name of Dandelion, which was an autobiography about her various trysts. So if you go back and listen to the Jimmy Savile series I did where I talked about how having relations with underage girls was extremely common in the entertainment industry, I know some people brush that off as being untrue. Sebring is another one, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of others who partook in this type of behavior. And society at the time just brushed it off. Tate stated about this particular relationship of Sebring that it was really immature of him, to which Sebring is reported to have replied that the 15-year-old was very mature for her age and knew absolutely everything. So it's just an interesting piece of information, especially when you consider the fact that up until about 15 years ago, things like this were still not only very common, but very openly talked about within the entertainment industry. A great example of that, at least accusations of this, comes from John Kay, the creator of Ren and Stimpy, who was accused a few years ago of grooming two underage girls, and that one of these girls was 16 or 17 when the much older John Kay began dating her. In any event, Tate ends up eventually coming back to California during 1966, and she continues her friendship with Jay Sebring, which maybe it's just me, but there's something odd about this entire situation, that where both men who are said to have been extremely controlling are carrying on these relationships with Tate, the men being Jay Sebring and Roman Polanski. I can't see, from everything I have read about him, and again, this is just my opinion, Polanski being okay with his soon-to-be wife carrying on this deep relationship with her ex-fiancé, but it did happen. The career front, Tate ended up starring in another god-awful movie by the name of Don't Make Waves, which, if memory serves me right, was another B-type movie that at the time was lauded as it's going to be this amazing thing if Tony Curtis was in it. But again, it was really just another film to show off sexpot Hollywood starlets, in this case, Sharon Tate in a bikini. Around the time of Don't Make Waves, Sharon Tate, who was back in London off and on to live with Polanski, really began to make some waves of her own with Rantzenoff, attempting to get out of her contract with Filmways, which was paying her $750 a week. By 1967, Sharon ends up getting a starring role in the movie Valley of the Dolls, which was pretty much universally panned, which isn't surprising given the fact that Tate was in it. Although this movie, despite being universally despised at the time, has become a really kitsch cult film, and it actually elevated Sharon's status in Hollywood. At the time of the movie being made, Sharon was doing a lot of different interviews. I'm going to read you a quote from one of these interviews. "People look at me, and all they see is a sexy theme. I mean, people see sexy. I mean, sexy is all they see." It's just my opinion. I don't want anybody going and getting a lawyer, but I read things like this and it makes me think that maybe drugs were playing a much heavier role in these individuals' lives at this point. Because just a quip like that really doesn't make any sense. There's no depth to the statement. No cohesion of thought. And it is known that at this time, the Hollywood machine was in full swing. You had actors and actresses running around sleeping with one another. And drug usage was at an all-time high. And that's not speculation, that is fact. That the majority of those working in Hollywood during this period were just party animals. It doesn't get reported on as much nowadays, and I think it's because public opinion has shifted on that particular subject. It does still happen today. In fact, that's really what these individuals do with their free time. But during this period, the late 1960s, heavy drug usage was rampant. And this drug usage obviously brings in some rather unsavory characters, one of whom is an individual by the name of Charles Manson, who we will be discussing here in the not-too-distant future. But Manson came in to this whole celebrity scene via his music and drugs. While all of this was going on in Sharon's world, Polanski, with the company he had set up, Cadre Films, was in the process of securing the rights to Ira Levin's book, Rosemary's Baby, which, if you're unaware of the book or the movie, it basically tells the story of a well-to-do couple who the wife becomes pregnant with the Antichrist. Film was a very successful endeavor for Polanski, with some indications stating that he netted around $150,000 from doing this movie. During the early stages of production for the film, he secured a house for both himself and Tate on the beach in California. And from, again, all accounts, it seems as though they had a fairly, quote-unquote, normal relationship by Hollywood standards. Although there are storied rumors that state that there was a whole lot of drug use and swinging going on within and around their household. While they were living in this beach house, Polanski met Sharon Tate's father, Paul Tate, who, if you'll remember, worked in the military intelligence division, specifically at this point in Vietnam. Stories about their meeting are conflicting, with some stating that the elder Tate did not like the fact that his daughter was living with Polanski, and that it took Polanski the most of the day to win the man over, although other stories state that Polanski and Paul Tate hit it off almost immediately. However, which version of events you choose to believe is really up to you. I like to believe that Paul Tate was not happy that his daughter was living with this kind of swinging European director, and that he had a good talk with the man before eventually warming up to him. Throughout 1967, Valley of the Dolls premiered, which again, it was panned. Polanski continued his work on Rosemary's Baby, going over, by some estimates, as much as $400,000 to $500,000 over budget. And Tate finally secured her release from her contract with Ransomoff by telling him that she wanted to retire in order to start a family with Polanski. Which, if you know anything about Hollywood, which was just a big fat bag of lies, she did not feel that, despite having really no talent as an actress, she was being paid enough and wanted out of the contract, and Ransomoff agreed to this. More in a moment.
For Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers, quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie. Hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. Ebook pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
On January 20th of 1968, Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski married. Polanski later stated that he really wasn't interested in getting married, although he knew that he needed to if he wanted to really continue his relationship with Sharon, as she wanted children and had been raised as a Catholic, and apparently, and this is sort of an oxymoron given the life that she had been living, she saw it as something like a sin to have children out of the wedlock. Sharon and Roman ended up being married in London, which precluded her parents from attending the ceremony, and by all accounts, they dressed like quote-unquote rich hippies, and the parties and revelry that took place after the wedding are said to have been fairly debaucherous, although I have not been able to find anything to really explain what is meant by that statement, although I imagine there was a lot of drinking and heavy drug usage. This wedding received a lot of attention internationally in the press, which really started to frame the narrative of both Polanski and Sharon Tate as this wonderful whirlwind love affair. A guest later stated concerning the wedding that it was obvious to everyone there that Sharon was, quote-unquote, completely under Roman's domination. He doesn't look it, but he must be a dominating man. After this, they went to the Swiss Alps to ski for their honeymoon. Reportedly, Polanski got into a fight with an individual while they were on their honeymoon after Sharon was seen wearing a miniskirt, and as a result, Polanski ended up with a broken arm and stitches. One quote from Sharon from this period is pretty telling. "I'm not inhibited at all. I just do what I want. If I feel like it, I flirt with a cab driver. I like new things, try new sensations. Why not?" And I read that because, as I mentioned in the first episode, Sharon Tate's life in Hollywood is really a story of, in my opinion, someone who was eaten by the machine and inundated with all sorts of temptations and debauchery. People will disagree with my views on this, but I honestly think that it's not surprising how her life ends, given what we know of it, what she and those who were within her inner circle were involved in. She was really deflowered by the Hollywood society and, you know, the drug use, the free sex, etc., etc. In a rather telling quote from Sharon, she states, "It's funny, Hollywood is a very depraved place, the hell's door, but knows how to be Victorian when it's about beginners like me." What she was talking about in this regard was her relationship with Roman Polanski. According to Sharon, her former manager, Marty Rantzenoff, had become upset with her because she was dating this guy and living with him, and then engaged to this guy and living with him, and now she was living with Roman Polanski. And according to Sharon, he told her, just because of the image they were trying to project of her, that if she was going to live with Polanski, then she needed to marry him as opposed to running around with men left and right. Because at this point, and it's still true to some respects today, men were seen as being, you know, adventurous sexual beings, and it was okay for them to run around and have as many different partners as they wanted. However, for women to do it within Hollywood was frowned upon. This despite the fact that it is known that Hollywood producers and directors traded starlets amongst each other like they were baseball cards. Apparently, Rantzenoff, at least according to Tate, did not want that image for her. So now she's married with Polanski. They are jet-setting around the world as he works on various film projects, and they were constantly being photographed and talked about in all of the various rags that push the mythos of celebrity. We're going to diverge a little bit at this point from talking about Roman and Sharon to talk about the culture in and around Hollywood at this point. And the reason for that is it does play a part in what is to come on the murders that take place. Hollywood, by the late 1960s, was a soulless town. It had always been so, but by the 1960s, with the infusion of drugs and the mixing of rock and roll musicians and Hollywood elite, that soullessness soared to new levels, and a lot of entertainers began dabbling in different forms of religion. There are some who are going to point to this section and say, oh, this is conspiracy theory bullshit, but unfortunately for them, it is not. It is documented as factual and as having taken place. What I am talking about is the occult. Whether you believe in it as something that actually has power or just stories that have been told to, you know, sell books and movies, there are numerous occult groups throughout the world. There was one group in particular who were known as the Process Church of the Final Judgment. For those of you who have heard the series I did on the Son of Sam killer, you will be somewhat familiar with the Process Church of the Final Judgment. They were an offshoot of one of Aleister Crowley's organizations from England, who left Great Britain in the 1960s and resettled in Los Angeles. As the stories go, they interacted with a slew of different individuals within Hollywood, one of whom was supposedly Warren Beatty, another of whom was said to be Charles Manson, who during this period of time hadn't really found his niche yet and was just bouncing around from scene to scene. This organization called the Process Church of the Final Judgment, it's said that John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, who features into innumerable bad scenes within Hollywood, had befriended the leaders of this organization and donated Lord knows how much money to them. According to a report by an INS agent that was prepared in 1974, it was found that this organization had attended parties thrown throughout Hollywood and Los Angeles. One of these parties took place at Sharon Tate's home, which she shared with Roman Polanski. This was supposedly at some point in 1967 or 1968. Some reports state that Sirhan Sirhan, who would go on to assassinate Robert Kennedy, was at one of these parties, particularly this one that had been held at the Tate-Polanski household, and that during this party, satanic rites of some description were performed that involved heavy drug usage and orgies. And the reason that I bring this up now is because these are themes that, as the story progresses, are going to continuously come up in regards to not only Charles Manson, but the Tate-LaBianca murders, specifically the Tate household at Cielo Drive. Whether or not all of this is actually true or just flights of fancy from the disturbed minds of individuals who want to find a conspiracy in everything, and by this I mean there are some people who believe what happened to Sharon Tate was the result of their involvement in the occult, and that Charles Manson had actually been ordered by this cult to remove Tate and anyone else who was in the house. I personally don't believe that line of thought, but I do find it much more than simple coincidence that there's a report from 1974 stating that she had interactions with this organization, and in fact they had attended a party that she had thrown and had been in attendance at parties that both she and Polanski were at throughout 1967 and 1968. And Charles Manson has admittedly had contact with this group and further went on to state that he learned some of his techniques from these individuals. There are further conspiracies that state that the Process Church of the Final Judgment was a CIA black op designed to mind control individuals into doing things they wanted, such as Manson. These same individuals claim that Manson was a CIA subject and that the murders took place either at the behest of his handlers or because his quote-unquote programming drove him and his followers to do it. We will never know the truth of that. If you believe it, more power to you. There is a book out about that particular subject that's gained a lot of popularity since being released called 6 Degrees of Helter Skelter. In any event, though, you can see there's a lot of depraved activity going on around Tate and Polanski. It's not just simple partying, going out for drinks. There's heavy drug usage. It's been known for decades that mass orgies, etc., took place in Hollywood during this period of time. For all I know, they still are taking place, but it is known that these types of things were happening at this period of time, and that Tate was involved in some of this. So you have all of this going on, the, we're going to call them spiritual quests, for lack of a better term, of the Hollywood elite, which includes Sharon and Roman. Heavy drug usage, and into this mix is going to come a convicted felon by the name of Charles Manson. I'm going to touch briefly on Manson here before we really get into him next week. Just giving you an idea of how he got involved in this scene. Manson was released from prison and ended up in Los Angeles, where it is said for a time he ran a prostitution ring. Some people have said that it was an escort service. Manson was on parole at this point. And during some period, his parole officer allowed him to go up to San Francisco, which is where the hippies were hanging out at. And really, up in San Francisco is where Manson became Manson. He was a huckster and a con artist and all of these other things, but up in San Francisco, when he was introduced to the hippie scene, he really found his home. Some have stated this was because he saw a lot of free love for, use the vernacular of the time, which is a nice way to say that everybody was sleeping with everybody else. Others have stated he saw hundreds of young girls who could be easily exploited and molded to do his bidding. Others still have stated that he went up there, and once getting up there and falling in with the scene, he had an honest desire to pursue a career in music. I personally think that it was a combination of all three. I think Manson went up there to get out from underneath the watchful eye of his parole officer, but also to find out what all of the hubbub was about, and while he was up there, he found things like free love and saw all of these easily manipulated individuals using drugs and was able to kind of carve out an area for himself, and in doing so, he started attracting followers as Manson did try to build a music career. It has been said that while he was up in San Francisco, he was a member of Scientology, and the church is quick to point out that he was briefly aligned with it, but left almost before it was even noticed that he was within the organization. It's also been said that he was aligned for a period of time with Anton LaVey's Church of Satan, which was based out of Los Angeles. Manson himself stated that he had had interactions with these organizations, particularly Scientology, and that he learned quite a bit from Scientology, which he would later use in his own teachings. It is very probable that Manson ran in the same circles as members of the Church of Satan for the simple fact that the Church of Satan at this period of time was kind of pulling in the dregs of society. You know, the outsider artists and those who were disenfranchised with both organized religion and organized society as a whole. Susan Atkins, who was a member of Charles Manson's family and possibly the most infamous member of the family, was in at least one film of a satanic rite where she was used as the altar. By that, I mean she was videotaped being naked while Anton LaVey did a ceremony over her, and if I'm not mistaken, this was a film that was shot by outsider filmmaker Kenneth Enger, who is either an avowed Satanist or an avowed occultist. I forget which, they kind of blend together in my mind. But regardless, Atkins was at least on the periphery of the satanic church, which Manson almost certainly would have come into contact with during his time in San Francisco. And I'm not saying that he met Susan Atkins through the Church of Satan. In fact, if you can find a copy of Susan Atkins' book, she states that she met him, I believe, down in Los Angeles, but it's just one of those funny coincidences. So anyways, you've got Manson, he's in LA, he's up in San Francisco, he's back in LA, he's bouncing back and forth during this period of time, coming into contact with all sorts of individuals, some of them decent individuals, some of them not so decent, one of whom is a man by the name of Terry Melcher, who was Doris Day's son, who had a record company. And Manson greatly wanted to get a deal for himself and his girls so that they could put out music. And as I'm going to try and explain in the next episode, where we leave off completely Sharon Tate for a while and focus solely on Manson, there are a lot of interconnecting threads concerning him, his girls, the Hollywood elite, and really anything else that you could hope to, you know, connect together. I think I stated this in the first episode, if not, I'm going to state it now. I'm not going to be able to cover every single aspect of Charles Manson, the family, the Tate-LaBianca murders, because I would be here for 5 or 6 years trying to cover it all, but I am going to cover what I believe to be, if not the most important, at least the most interesting of these aspects and interconnections. which I have briefly touched on here concerning Manson, his connections to Hollywood, as well as his connections to various esoteric cults of thought. And I really believe that it was his connections to these various organizations, as well as to the Hollywood elite, that led him to send out his followers to commit the crimes that they did. Be aware, if you listen past this, I am going to mention stuff that is in the realm of conspiracy theory, just because it has become such a contentious talking point in regards to this story. But as always, I'm going to present it in such a manner that it's up to you whether or not you believe those particular avenues. I'm going to call it here. Thank you for listening. I apologize for any sounds that you may hear in the background. It is fairly muggy and humid here at this point, so we have all of the fans going on in the studio in an attempt to cool it down. But I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Until next week, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Till next time, stay morbid.